Chapter 14. In my double quality of page and secretary, I followed Joan to the council. She entered that presence with the bearing of a grieved goddess. What was become of the volatile child, that so lately was enchanted with a ribbon, and suffocated with laughter over the distress of a foolish peasant who had stormed a funeral on the back of a bee-stung bull? One may not guess. Simply it was gone, and had left no sign. She moved straight to the council table, and stood. Her glance swept from face to face there, and where it fell, these lit it, as with a torch, those it scorched, as with a brand. She knew where to strike. She indicated the generals with a nod, and said, "My business is not with you. You have not craved a council of war." Then she turned toward the king's privy council, and continued, "No, it is with you. A council of war. It is amazing. There is but one thing to do, and only one, and lo, ye call a council of war. Councils of war have no value, but to decide between two or several doubtful courses. But a council of war, when there is only one course. Conceive of a man in a boat, and his family in the water, and he goes out among his friends, to ask what he would better do? A council of war, name of God. To determine what?" She stopped, and turned till her eyes rested upon the face of La Tremoille, and so she stood, silent, measuring him, the excitement in all faces burning steadily higher and higher, and all pulses beating faster and faster. Then she said, with deliberation, "Every sane man whose loyalty is to his king, and not a show and a pretense, knows that there is but one rational thing before us, the march upon Paris." Down came the fist of La Hire with an approving crash upon the table. La Tremoille turned white with anger, but he pulled himself firmly together, and held his peace. The king's lazy blood was stirred, and his eye kindled finely, for the spirit of war was away down in him somewhere, and a frank, bold speech always found it, and made it tingle gladsomely. Joan waited to see if the chief minister might wish to defend his position. But he was experienced and wise, and not a man to waste his forces where the current was against him. He would wait. The king's private ear would be at his disposal by and by. That pious fox, the Chancellor of France, took the word now. He washed his soft hands together, smiling persuasively, and said to Joan, "Would it be courteous, Your Excellency, to move abruptly from here without waiting for an answer from the Duke of Burgundy? You may not know that we are negotiating with His Highness, and that there is likely to be a fortnight's truce between us, and on his part a pledge to deliver Paris into our hands without the cost of a blow, or the fatigue of a march thither." Joan turned to him and said, gravely, "This is not a confessional, my lord. You were not obliged to expose that shame here." The Chancellor's face reddened, and he retorted, "Shame? What is there shameful about it?" Joan answered in level, passionless tones, "One may describe it without hunting far for words. I knew of this poor comedy, my lord, although it was not intended that I should know. It is to the credit of the devisers of it that they tried to conceal it, this comedy whose text and impulse are describable in two words." The Chancellor spoke up with a fine irony in his manner. "Indeed? And will Your Excellency be good enough to utter them? Cowardice and treachery." The fists of all the generals came down this time, and again the king's eye sparkled with pleasure. The Chancellor sprang to his feet and appealed to His Majesty. "Sire, I claim your protection." But the king waved him to his seat again, saying, "Peace." As he had a right to be consulted before that thing was undertaken, since it concerned war as well as politics. It is but just that she be heard upon it now. The Chancellor sat down trembling with indignation, and remarked to Joan, "Out of charity I will consider that you did not know who devised this measure which you condemn in so candid language." "Save your charity for another occasion, my lord," said Joan, as calmly as before. "D W whenever anything is done to injure the interests and degrade the honor of France. All but the dead know how to name the two conspirators in chief, sir, sire. This insinuation, it is not an insinuation, my lord, said Joan, placidly, it is a charge. I bring it against the king's chief minister and his chancellor. Both men were on their feet now, insisting that the king modify Joan's frankness, but he was not minded to do it. His ordinary counsels were stale water, his spirit was drinking wine now, and the taste of it was good. He said, sit and be patient. What is fair for one must in fairness be allowed the other. Consider and be just. When have you two spared her? What dark charges and harsh names have you withheld when you spoke of her? Then he added, with a veiled twinkle in his eyes, if these are offenses I see no particular difference between them, except that she says her hard things to your faces, whereas you say yours behind her back. He was pleased with that neat shot, and the way it shriveled those two people up, and made La Hire laugh out loud, and the other generals softly quake and chuckle. Joan tranquilly resumed. From the first, we have been hindered by this policy of shilly-shally, this fashion of counseling and counseling and counseling where no counseling is needed, but only fighting. We took Orleans on the 8th of May, and could have cleared the region round about in 3 days, and saved the slaughter of Patay. We could have been in Reims 6 weeks ago, and in Paris now, and would see the last Englishman pass out of France in half a year. But we struck no blow after Orleans, but went off into the country what for? Ostensibly to hold councils, really to give Bedford time to send reinforcements to Talbot, which he did, and Patay had to be fought. After Patay, more counseling, more waste of precious time. Oh, my king, I would that you would be persuaded. She began to warm up now. Once more we have our opportunity. If we rise and strike, all is well. Bid me march upon Paris. In 20 days it shall be yours, and in 6 months all France. Here is half a year's work before us. If this chance be wasted, I give you 20 years to do it in. Speak the word, O gentle king, speak, but the one, I cry you mercy, interrupted the chancellor, who saw a dangerous enthusiasm rising in the king's face. March upon Paris? Does your excellency forget that the way bristles with English strongholds? That for your English strongholds. And Joan snapped her fingers scornfully. Whence have we marched in these last days? From Guine. And whither? To Reims. What bristled between? English strongholds. What are they now? French ones, and they never cost a blow. Here applause broke out from the group of generals, and Joan had to pause a moment to let it subside. Why yes, English strongholds bristled before us, now French ones bristle behind us. What is the argument? A child can read it. The strongholds between us and Paris are garrisoned by no new breed of English, but by the same breed as those others, with the same fears, the same questionings, the same weaknesses, the same disposition to see the heavy hand of God descending upon them. We have but to march. On the instant, and they are ours. Paris is ours. France is ours. Give the word, O my king, command your servant to stay, cried the chancellor. It would be madness to put our affront upon His Highness the Duke of Burgundy. By the treaty which we have every hope to make with him, oh, the treaty which we hope to make with him. He has scorned you for years, and defied you. Is it your subtle persuasions that have softened his manners, and beguiled him to listen to proposals? No, it was blows. The blows which we gave him. That is the only teaching that sturdy rebel can understand. What does he care for wind? The treaty which we hope to make with him, alack. He deliver Paris. There is no pauper in the land that is less able to do it. He deliver Paris. Ah, but that would make great Bedford smile. Oh, the pitiful pretext, the blind can see that this thin poor parlor with its 15-day truce has no purpose but to give Bedford time to hurry forward his forces against us. More treachery, always treachery. We call a council of war with nothing to counsel about, but Bedford calls no council to teach him what our course is. He knows what he would do in our place. He would hang his traitors and march upon Paris. O gentle king, rouse. The way is open, Paris beckons, France implores. Speak and we, sire, it is madness, sheer madness. Your Excellency, we cannot, we must not go back from what we have done. We have proposed to treat, we must treat with the Duke of Burgundy. And we will, said Joan. Ah? How? At the point of the lance. The house rose, to a man all that at French hearts, and let go a crash of applause and kept it up. And in the midst of it one heard La Hire growl out colon at the point of the lance. By God, that is music. The king was up to, and drew his sword, and took it by the blade, and strode to Joan, and delivered the hilt of it into her hand, saying, there, the king surrenders. Carry it to Paris. And so the applause burst out again, and the historical C09 Uncil of War, that has bred so many legends, was over. Chapter 39 We win, but the king box, it was away past midnight, and had been a tremendous day in the matter of excitement and fatigue, but that was no matter to Joan, when there was business on hand. She did not think of bed. The generals followed her to her official quarters, and she delivered her orders to them as fast as she could talk, and they sent them off to their different commands as fast as delivered. Wherefore the messengers galloping hither and thither raised a world of clatter and racket in the still streets, and soon were added to this the music of distant bugles, and the roll of drums, notes of preparation, for the vanguard would break camp at dawn. The generals were soon dismissed, but I wasn't, nor Joan, for it was my turn to work now. Joan walked the floor, and dictated a summons to the Duke of Burgundy, to lay down his arms and make peace and exchange pardons with the king, or, if he must fight, go fight the Saracens. P. Pardonis vous l'un lauder de bon si and elig, anti-ermond, ains I k doivent fair loyox credians, et, sil vous plate de guerrier, alles contre les Saracens. It was long, but it was good, and had the sterling ring to it. It is my opinion, that it was as fine and simple and straightforward and eloquent a state paper as she ever uttered. It was delivered into the hands of a courier, and he galloped away with it. The Joan dismissed me, and told me to go to the inn and stay, and in the morning give to her father the parcel which she had left there. It contained presents for the Domremy relatives and friends, and a peasant dress which she had bought for herself. She said she would say goodbye to her father and uncle in the morning, if it should still be their purpose to go, instead of tarrying a while to see the city. I didn't say anything, of course, but I could have said that wild horses couldn't keep those men in that town half a day. They waste the glory of being the first to carry the great news to Domremy, the taxes remitted forever. And hear the bells clang and clatter, and the people cheer and shout? Oh, not they. Pate and Orleans and the coronation were events which in a vague way these men understood to be colossal. But they were colossal mists, films, abstractions. This was a gigantic reality. When I got there, do you suppose they were abed? Quite the reverse. They and the rest were as mellow could be, and the paladin was doing his battles in great style, and the old peasants were endangering the building with their applause. He was doing pâté now, and was bending his big frame forward, and laying out the positions and movements with a rake here, and a rake there of his formidable sword on the floor, and the peasants were stooped over with their hands on their spread knees observing with excited eyes, and ripping out ejaculations of wonder and admiration all along. Yes, here we were, waiting for the word. Our horses fidgeting and snorting and dancing to get away, we lying back on the bridles till our bodies fairly slanted to the rear. The word rang out at last, go. ... and we went. Went? There was nothing like it ever seen. Where we swept by squads of scampering English, the mere wind of our passage laid them flat in piles and rows. Then we plunged into the ruck of Fastolf's frantic battle corps, and tore through it like a hurricane, leaving a causeway of the dead stretching far behind. No tarrying, no slacking rein, but on, on, on. Far yonder in the distance lay our prey Talbot and his host looming vast, and dark like a storm cloud brooding on the sea. Down we swooped upon them, glooming all the air with a quivering pall of dead leaves flung up by the whirlwind of our flight. In another moment we should have struck them as world strikes world, when disorbited constellations crash into the Milky Way, but by misfortune and the inscrutable dispensation of God I was recognized. Talbot turned white, and shouting, "Save yourselves, it is the standard bearer of Joan of Arc!" drove his spurs home till they met in the middle of his horse's entrails, and fled the field with his billowing multitudes at his back. I could have cursed myself for not putting on a disguise. I saw reproach in the eyes of Her Excellency, and was bitterly ashamed. I had caused what seemed an irreparable disaster. Another might have gone aside to grieve, as not seeing any way to mend it. But I thank God I am not of those. Great occasions only summon, as with a trumpet call, the slumbering reserves of my intellect. I saw my opportunity in an instant, and the next I was away. Through the woods I vanished FST, like an extinguished light. Away around through the curtaining forest I sped, as if on wings, none knowing what was become of me, none suspecting my design. Minute after minute passed, on and on I flew, on, and still on, and at last with a great cheer I flung my banner to the breeze, and burst out in front of Talbot. Oh, it was a mighty thought! That weltering chaos of distracted men whirled and surged backward like a tidal wave which has struck a continent, and the day was ours. Poor helpless creatures, they were in a trap, they were surrounded. They could not escape to the rear, for there was our army. They could not escape to the front, for there was one. Their hearts shriveled in their bodies, their hands fell listless at their sides. They stood still, and at our leisure we slaughtered them to a man, all except Talbot and Fastolf, whom I saved and brought away, one under each arm. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.